On the evening of December 10th, 2019, at the Country Bookshelf, local Bozeman historian and director of the Gallatin Historical Society, John C. Russell, read from his book, Treasure State Tycoon, Nelson's Story and the Making of Montana, published by the Montana Historical Society Press. He is introduced by the Country Bookshelf's Jessica Hale.
We are absolutely delighted to welcome John Russell to share his book, The Treasure State Tycoon. As a local author, we love supporting our local authors, and having you all here this evening really helps us do that. We do many events throughout the year. You can listen to a lot of them through KGVM, actually, our local community radio station. But we were absolutely delighted to welcome John as both a local author. He's the director of the Gallatin History Museum just across the street. And this is one of our most anticipated and hotly desired titles of local history. So without further ado, John Russell.
Thanks, Jessica. And Nelson's story, ever since I moved here back in the mid-70s, kind of intrigued about who this guy was. You had Story Street, Story Motors, Story Hills, Story this, Story that. Who was this guy? And 1994, I started researching him and putting things together. And to give a presentation here this evening, I thought what I would do is talk a little bit, but also let portions of the book itself kind of do some talking for me. And in the introduction, William Friend Day, pastor of St. James Episcopal Church in Bozeman, Montana, had spent nearly a week contemplating the eulogy he would deliver the afternoon of March 17, 1926. In his short time at St. James, Day had already presided over five funerals, each time offering comfort to the deceased family and, by extension, to the community itself. He always emphasized the person's achievements and Christian attributes, avoiding any mention of failings or character flaws that might have been unbeknownst to those outside the immediate family. But this service would be for a man whose successes and shortcomings were both solidly in the public domain. Nelson Story had been the most dominant figure in the town's 62-year history, and Day knew any effort to omit his failings would render the tribute disingenuous. I took a lot of space there to basically say, you can't sugarcoat this guy. He was a quintessential Western capitalist. He was to Montana what Leland Stanford, for example, was to California, or Mike Iliff to Colorado, John Creighton to Nebraska. Nelson Story was that to Montana, although he didn't get quite all the publicity that these guys got. He was from Ohio, and in the late 1850s, in the wake of the Kansas-Nebraska Act, he moved to Kansas by himself when he was 18 years old. As you know, in Kansas, it was set up with the Kansas-Nebraska Act where voters would decide whether Kansas would be free or slave. So he got in the middle of that confrontation. While there, met a girl from Missouri, Ellen Trent, and he freighted between Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and Denver, Colorado, the Pikes Peak Gold Rush, and he also dug fence posts. He did just about anything he could to earn a living. And with the Pikes Peak Gold Rush, here was a chance for him to open up a mercantile store in Denver. So he and Ellen went there. This would have been in 1862. They weren't there very long before word trickled out about a gold strike along a place called Grasshopper Creek in what was then part of Washington Territory. Well, that turned out to be Bannock. And they came up, like a lot of other people, after just a few months in Denver, found out that Bannock was practically abandoned because of the new gold strike over in Alder Gulch. And so they followed. They came to Alder Gulch. And Ellen Trent Story was probably the first white woman to live in Alder Gulch. By the end of 1863, you had about 10,000 people there, all kinds of characters from all different walks of life. It was a fairly dangerous place, actually, to be. And Story set up a claim, made a claim, and over the years he did pretty well. He accumulated gold dust. He also was part of the vigilante movement. He partook in a couple of hangings. As you know, with the vigilantes, some of them may not have been guilty at all. We really don't know. But it's a safe bet. Not all of them were road agents. But they kind of had the attitude back then of, well, we'll hang them all and let God sort them out. That kind of way of looking at it. After a couple of years of gold mining in Alder Gulch, with the end of the Civil War, Nelson Story learned that down in Texas, the population of longhorn cattle had just taken off, had really proliferated. And there were millions of cows, longhorn steers, roaming Texas. During the Civil War, all the men were off fighting for the bars and stars. There was nobody there to control the herds. And now in the wake of the end of the Civil War, you had a situation where you could buy a longhorn steer for as little as $5 a head, maybe $10 a head. If you got it to one of the western forts, you could sell it for $20 a head. If you got that same steer up to Chicago, you could get $40 a head. So an investment of $5 in Texas could turn into a pretty good return in various parts of the country. Story decided, though, to bring a herd of cattle up to the Yellowstone Valley. And as you read accounts of the cattle drive, and this is what he's best known for in the annals of the American West, is bringing up the first herd of longhorns to Montana, you'll see two figures, 600 and 1,000. Some say he brought 600 head. Others say he brought 1,000 head. If you see that they claim he brought 3,000 head, don't buy that magazine or book, because that's wrong. It gets down to between 600 and 1,000. So which one is the right answer? Here's a politician's answer for you. Both. He started out with 600 head when he left Texas. Went up through the Indian Territory into southeastern Kansas. And there at a roadblock put up by Jayhawkers and Missouri bushwhackers, charging money to all these cattlemen who wanted to take their cattle into Kansas, claiming these cattle were infected with tick fever, they were going to make them pay a bounty to get in. A lot of cattlemen just gave up, sold some of their herd. Nelson Story acquired more cattle there, headed west to Wichita, swung around back up to Fort Leavenworth. From Fort Leavenworth, he continued on the Oregon Trail. He had hired several men down in Texas, and now he had to hire more on the Oregon Trail because, with all the fighting along the Bozeman Trail, the government mandated that any train, i.e. like Nelson Story's, that was going to be going along the Bozeman Trail, you had to have at least 30 men. So he had 1,000 head of cattle. He also had several wagons loaded with supplies to start a mercantile store here in Bozeman and proceeded up the Oregon Trail and eventually accumulated 30 men, branched off onto the Bozeman Trail, had several fights with the Sioux and Cheyenne, finally reaching Fort Phil Kearny, where the commander there, Colonel Carrington, told him, this would have been in late September, October of 1866. The commander there told him he had to stay and wait until another train came along because he didn't have enough people with him. Well, Story put up a fuss because one of the things he had done in Kansas is he purchased these brand new Remington repeating rifles. So his men were well armed. In the fights they had lost a couple of men who were wounded or killed. But still, he wanted to proceed on rather than being stuck at Fort Phil Kearny with winter just around the corner. So he went back and forth with Carrington, who refused to let him leave until another train came along. And at that time of year, another train just was not going to come along. Make a long story short, no pun intended, he decided one night after a man was killed by Indians there, he gathered up his men and said, all right, here's the deal. We can wait here for another wagon train like the Army wants us to, but I don't think another one's coming. There are Indians all around us. If we don't get to Bozeman, if we don't get to the Yellowstone Valley, nobody here gets a paycheck. We can wait or we can sneak out of here. And all but one man voted to sneak out at night. The one guy who voted no was George Dow, and Nelson Story being Nelson Story, he immediately ordered Dow tied up, bound and gagged, and tossed into the back of a wagon so he wouldn't spill the beans. Somehow, some way, they made it out of there at night. They got away from Fort Phil Kearny and continued on and reached the Yellowstone Valley near present-day Livingston. That's where his cow camp, where he established his cow camp, over where the Shields River meets the Yellowstone. Established that cow camp in early December of 1866. So Nelson's story was he started out as a manual laborer in Kansas, did well, hit some gold in Alder Gulch enough to finance his venture with cattle and a mercantile store that he wanted to open up here in Bozeman. That gets back to what I was talking about earlier, him being the quintessential Western capitalist. The most successful Western capitalists were those who diversified. Getting back, for example, to Leland Stanford, he was in mercantile and he eventually got into railroads and so forth and so on. Nelson's story was the same way. The town of Bozeman, founded by its namesake, was just in the early stages of growth and development in 1866, 1867. John Bozeman ends up getting killed over along the Yellowstone. History tries to tell us he and his partner Tom Cover were attacked by Blackfeet warriors, and John Bozeman was killed and Cover escaped. But the evidence strongly suggests Tom Cover killed John Bozeman because he thought John Bozeman was becoming a little too friendly with Mrs. Cover. It's one of those we'll never know for certain, but it also falls under the heading, if it ain't true, it ought to be, because it makes good theater. John Bozeman didn't have too many friends in this town, even though he's responsible for the founding of the town and the trail that bears his name. Because he was handsome, if you were a settler here and you had a wife, a daughter, or a girlfriend, you didn't like him. He was from Georgia, so if you were a Union sympathizer, you didn't like him. He was a Democrat, and if you were Republican, pro-Lincoln, you didn't like him. And after the Civil War, when Southern veterans came out here, they didn't like him because he wasn't back in Georgia fighting for the Confederacy during the war. So there weren't too many tears shed when he met his demise. They used that death and others to pester the Army to build a fort near this area to help protect the continued flow of gold back east as the gold was being mined. So Fort Ellis was established just to the east of here. Nelson Story positioned himself very well to be a go-between between the fort and local farmers as well. You remember, he had his cattle, a good 1,000 head over in the Yellowstone Valley now, that he could sell to the Army. He could also buy foodstuffs from local farmers and then sell it to the Army at a markup. Also nearby was the Crow Reservation. The Crow Reservation in those days was everything south of the Yellowstone River and north of the Wyoming line. So that included the Paradise Valley. That was part of the Crow Reservation in 1867, 1868. He got contracts to serve the Crow Reservation, to supply foodstuffs. We'll get back to more of that in a minute. because a lot of the dealings he did with the Army were rather underhanded. And the same goes for how he handled the Crow Agency. He had allies within the agency administration helping him, and basically through a little shenanigans and thievery, he managed to make quite a bit of money. So he was one of those entrepreneurs. Everything he touched, he had the Midas touch almost. Everything that he touched worked out for him, all the way from gold, cattle, and now government contracts for both the Crow Reservation as well as Fort Ellis. He also was an opportunist. When the forts along the Bozeman Trail closed, he went to one of them. It was Fort C.F. Smith over on the Bighorn River. He went there, and the Army was abandoning the post, and they were trying to get rid of as much equipment as they can. So he bought all kinds of hardware and other goods from the Army at rock-bottom prices, loaded them on his wagons. He had hired a bunch of Teamsters, took them from Fort C.F. Smith to Bozeman and then up to Helena. Dutch ovens that he bought for $1 a piece at Fort C.F. Smith, he sold in Helena for $100 a piece. And other things in proportion. It was the basic supply and demand thing. People in Helena were willing to pay that much. So Nelson Story had to figure, who am I, you know, not to charge that much for them in order to have those. So that is another area where, once again, his opportunism helped him to profit and to profit greatly over what was going on at the time in the American West. As far as his family is concerned, he and Ellen would have four children. Actually, she gave birth to a total of seven. But three daughters, three young girls, died in childhood. In those days, the child mortality rate was a heck of a lot higher. Diseases were more prevalent. The sanitation in most places was just horrendous. Bozeman was no exception. Bozeman, indeed, was a wild, wild west town. You had, with the creation especially of Fort Ellis, you had a proliferation in saloons, and you had a huge jump in, shall we say, hotels for single girls that were congregated over on the northeast side of town. Story, in addition to his other interests, partnered with one Leander Black for contracts with the Crow Reservation. He also purchased a lot of real estate. Nelson Story and Lester Wilson would eventually own a bank here, and that too kind of added to the coffers of his wealth. The government wanted to move the Crow Reservation at one point because of white encroachment. The way the government handled the Indian situation, whenever whites wanted to come onto Indian land to hunt, to mine for gold, what have you, as was the case over in the Yellowstone Valley, the way the government typically handled it was, rather than stop the white intrusion, they wanted to either shrink the reservation or relocate the Indian reservation altogether. There was a movement, it didn't work, but they were going to relocate the Crows up to the Judith Basin. And along those lines, Nelson Story, with his contracts, with his interests, he had his own trading store with the Crow Reservation. He was making plans to build a new trading post in the Judith Basin right near present-day Lewistown in order to service the reservation. And to give you an example of some of the shenanigans, in mid-October, Story dispatched an 8-to-10 wagon bull train to Mission Creek, that would be in the Judith, to be loaded with flour, bacon, sugar, coffee, tobacco, soap, dried apples, blankets, axes, and clothing for the new Judith agency. Story's wagon boss, William Carr, he noticed that the goods were annuities taken from the agency warehouse and rightfully designated for distribution to the Crows. In effect, Nelson Story was taking goods he had already sold to the government. He had already sold to the Crow Agency, taking them to the new trading post in the Judith so he could turn around and sell them again. Georgetown later corroborated the thievery, stating that the wagons were definitely loaded with government sugar. When he mentioned it to a fellow worker, he was told, don't ask any questions. What happened in Montana with the tragedy of the treatment of the American Indians also is mirrored all across the American West. Montana was really not much different in that vein. The treaty moving the Crow Reservation to the Judith was never, ever ratified. And so the entire thing fell apart. But Story, even though the reservation remained down along the Yellowstone, Story continued to do things, selling items twice. He might sell the government. He had the assistance of some of the agents. He would sell them horses for maybe 10, 15 bucks a head. Then a year later, buy them back for $5 a head and turn around and sell them in Bozeman or Helena or wherever and make another profit. So it just continued on and on. Dexter Clapp is one of those agents who corroborated with Nelson's story, basically to cheat the government and the Crow people. One of the commanders at Fort Ellis was aware of the shenanigans going on. They tried their best to raise the alarm with the authorities in Washington, D.C. This particular commander was General James S. Brisbane. He sent a letter attached with a report that had been put together by one Captain Edward Ball, who claimed he had proof that Story was cheating the Indians. But Story and his allies said Captain Ball was working for Leander Black, helping Leander Black cheat the Crow Agency. You didn't know who the good guy was, who the bad guy was. But when Ball sent in his report, General Brisbane enclosed a note with it, saying, "The within report is a damning record of the utter rascality now practiced by the thieves of the Indian Ring. The coolness with which these scoundrels offer to bribe an honorable and honest officer," meaning Ball, "of the government is astounding. If Nelson Story and Dexter Clapp were arrested and shot to death by musketry, it would be no more than such men deserve." Brisbane was not one of those who was ever invited to the Story house for social functions, as you can tell. However, the government always, Story was put on, not trial, but the accusations of his cheating the Crows with his contracts went before a grand jury twice. And both times they claimed there was not enough evidence to file formal charges. After the first effort failed here in Bozeman when the jury assembled, Story went around bragging, saying that it cost him $10,000 to bribe the jury. That's what he said, and based upon some withdrawals and what have you from banks up in Helena where he kept accounts, that appears to be pretty much the truth. Eventually, he got out of the contract business, Indian contract business, segued into milling the Story Mill property. That's something that he added in the 1880s, became a very, very successful miller. He was also one of those when Montana became a state, the legislature decided to let the electorate decide where the state capital would be. You'd think they would have just kept it in Helena, but they opened it up, and Bozeman put in Fort, Boulder put in Fort, Butte put in Fort, Anaconda, and of course Helena. And Bozeman ran a promotional campaign that Story helped with, saying that Bozeman was definitely the best place for the capital, because in Bozeman, we had the greenest grass, the best picket fences, the prettiest girls, and the healthiest babies. Why would you want the state capital anyplace else? Didn't work, as we all know. Capital stayed in Helena. Bozeman got the consolation prize, and Nelson's story was instrumental in donating land and money to make sure that the Montana College of Mechanic and Agriculture Arts came to Bozeman. It, of course, today is Montana State University. So if you look back on it, the efforts of Nelson Story didn't work to get the state capitol, but he did help secure the college. You look at all of that, and I think it's safe to conclude we got the better end of the deal rather than being the side of the state capitol. Just a quick sidebar, South 8th Avenue, the way it's laid out with the big median, that was designed to take you to the Capitol. Capitol is going to be up there where Wilson Hall is. The subdivision around the university is still called Capitol Hill Edition. They were so confident they were going to get, that's why the Bozeman Hotel was built. And a lot of other businesses and churches went through renovations. They thought they were a shoe-in, but a lot of corruption, a lot of graft in that, and details on all of this is in the book here. Story, one man said that he was light on fancy and hell for stout. He definitely had a very, very short fuse. He did have three sons. He had Nelson Jr., who was known as Bud. His second oldest son was Thomas Byron, who was called Bine. And then the youngest was Walter Story. He had one daughter who survived to maturity, Rose. And he and Ellen kind of doted on her and out and out spoiled her because of having lost three other girls. Story's temper, unfortunately, did permeate into that of his family, and that includes Ellen. There was a time when he lost his temper at one of the children in the late 1870s, and when after, I think it was Bud, and Ellen tried to intervene, and he backhanded Ellen across the face and left a very, very small permanent scar that she carried for the balance of her life. And a similar incident also occurred after the turn of the century. There was also a time in the 1890s, he told his two oldest sons, Bud and Bine, to go to his Northside Ranch, property he owned, where the mill is. There's a mule out there I want, bring it back, but don't rope that mule, just escort it back here. So Bud and Bine, they go do that. They're escorting the mule back into town, back to the Story house, the Story mansion, actually. And Bud just couldn't resist trying to lasso the animal. And he did. And then the mule trotted off into the Story yard before they could catch up with it and get that lasso off of it. Nelson was there in the yard. I thought I told you boys not to rope that mule. And Bud tried to give a excuse, and Nelson said, shut up. And the next one of you that says anything, I'm going to knock him off his horse. Well, Bine kind of had a little bit of the sarcastic element in him. And he said, well, we can rope any mule just as well as you can. And before he finished his sentence, Nelson had picked up a brick in the yard and threw it at him. If Bine had not ducked, I mean, it would have hit him right in the head. He hopped off his horse and headed for downtown with Nelson chasing him. Nelson was in his 50s then, so he couldn't really chase him too far with Nelson in pursuit. But Bine got away and waited until Story calmed down. The mansion, there's a lot of, maybe you've heard in the press, this, that, and the other thing about the Story mansion. The original Story mansion, the Story mansion, no longer exists. It used to be over where the Wilson School is now, built in 1886, 1887. He hired woodcrafters from Boston. He had stone imported, Carasota stone, for example, from Minnesota. This would turn out to be the finest mansion on the Northern Pacific Railroad route between the Twin Cities and Seattle. Now, in fairness, there wasn't a heck of a lot between the Twin Cities and Seattle, but still, it was quite the place. It was quite the mansion. The bricks were dipped in stale beer to preserve their color. I don't know what it is about stale beer that preserves the color of a brick, but for a long time there, I was worried about some of the stuff I drank when I was back in college. But, you know, I'm still breathing, so I guess it wasn't a huge matter. But if the mansion were still standing today, it'd be right across the street from Bamboo Garden. Torn down in the 1930s, get into that briefly in just a few minutes. The house on South Wilson, they call it Story Mansion, but it's really not. It was Bine's house. He and his wife and their children had it for 10 years before Bine lost his shirt in the wool business when the wool market collapsed after World War I. Nelson Story dabbled a little bit in politics. He was an alderman after the city of Bozeman was incorporated. He was even a candidate for the U.S. Senate. That was in the days when the state Senate chose the United States senators. So he was one of those who went up to Helena to shake hands and pat people on the back. But his reputation, that was pretty well known from those days of the Crow Reservation and some of the other things about him, precluded his getting into politics. He eventually sold his interest in his cattle herd, took the money, and starting in the 1880s, would every year take Ellen and the children down to Los Angeles, California. Had a winter home there. The Stories were among the very first snowbirds out of Bozeman. The Alderson family did that. The Wilson family did that. Your wealthier people all over the state did that. So he invested heavily in Los Angeles real estate. And that's where the Story family really made a lot of money. One of the first skyscrapers built in Los Angeles in 1911, it's still there, still used, is the Story Building. It's at the corner of 5th and Broadway. It was actually built by Nelson and one of his sons, Walter. Something of a humorous note, I guess you could say, is among his many rivals and enemies, Joe Lindley was one of them. It all started, Joe Lindley owned a couple of the Joy Houses, the Bordellos, over by the Bozeman Hotel. And according to Thomas Byron, what happened was Joe Lindley, he defaulted on a loan, and Nelson Story was the one who held the mortgage on the properties. So Nelson foreclosed on him. And according to Bine, his payments, Joe just didn't make the payments. And Bine was asked, well, why didn't Joe keep up with the payments? And Bine says, quote, Joe used to go down the line to collect rent, he later recalled. But instead of collecting, the sirens would ply him with ambrosia, braid ribbons in his whiskers, get him stinko, and before he could get any money, he'd owe them more than they owed him. That's Bine's version of why Joe Lindley had his bordellos foreclosed on him by the Story family. And the Story family basically took over operation of them. Lindley threatened lawsuits. Lindley went after him on this, that, and the other to such an extent that Lindley was even tried for his sanity here in Bozeman, an insanity hearing. And a panel of doctors ruled he was close to nuts, but not completely. He did not warrant being sent to the state hospital up in Warm Springs. Story would bump into him on the street here in Bozeman. They might break out into an argument. One time Story chased him across Main Street through Phillips Bookstore with his gun chasing him. The other time he used that same pistol, he whacked Joe Lindley right between the eyes when they had another argument on Main Street. That was Story's Navy Colt. And he, from that day forward, he referred to it as his Lindleyizer, because having used it on Joe Lindley. In the 1980s, Gallatin Empire Lions Club puts up a statue of Nelson Story. Where did they put it? Lindley Park. Poor Joe is still doing this in his grave. There are a lot more aspects of Nelson Story I could talk about up here. A very, very successful businessman, to put it plainly and to put it honestly, dishonest businessman. That is how business was done in the American West. Not trying to rationalize or forgive it, but that's how things were. The Gilded Age was not limited to the East Coast. It spread all across the country. Leland Stanford also had a lot of underhanded dealings. But Story, in addition to having that short fuse, his temper, played a huge role in the building of Bozeman. He could also be extremely charitable, support local churches, although he was not much of a churchgoer himself. And anybody, any family he knew of that was in need, he was always willing to help. But if you got on his wrong, bad side, when he decided to close his bank in the 1890s, the board of directors, Story told him he's going to close the bank. And one of the board of directors later said, and this was Dr. Henry Foster, physician, said, "Oh, that Story, somebody ought to take him out and hang him." Well, the word got back to Nelson. Nelson bumped into Foster on Main Street and proceeded to beat the heck out of him with his walking cane. Foster threatened a lawsuit. Story gave him $20,000 to forget the whole thing. Foster did so, took the $20,000, and built Bozeman's first hospital. That's how we got our first hospital, was a direct result of Nelson Story beating up a physician on Main Street. Dr. Foster, by the way, the first physician to perform a cesarean, C-section, west of the Mississippi. As mentioned at the beginning, Nelson Story died in 1926. Ellen preceded him in death. His children had kind of gone their separate ways. Bud had died in the early 1930s. They had no interest in preserving the Story Mansion. The school wanted that land to expand Wilson School. And this was during the Depression. And the Works Progress Administration was going to do the building. And so the school district purchased it from the Story family and decided to level it, raise it. So it's really too bad. But there, as I say, the Story family lost interest in preserving it. And during the Depression, everybody was worried about keeping their own property out of hawk. Not to belabor the point, but they like to call that house on South Wilson the Story Mansion. Well, no, it's not. Kind of a mea culpa, I think, for the fact the original, we lost it. Quite the legacy. This is the first in-depth biography on Nelson Story, and one of the main reasons no other has been done is because the family didn't want anybody to know all this stuff. With that, I'll take any questions.
With regard to the family, there's still a lot of stories around this area, right?
Right.
And when you're speaking about there's the story this, the story that, you see it all over. Are those businesses actually owned by the Story family?
Not anymore.
But I know over in Paradise Valley they still have the cattle ranch.
Yeah, that became Story's second cattle ranch down in that area by emigrant. And yeah, that did go down through the family, and now they operate it as kind of a hunting and fishing guide place. And I got to go over there with my wife and go into one of their storage barns. They took us in there. And you've got Nelson Story's saddle, his son's saddles. You've got the tin box he used to transport his gold back east to cash it in. You've got carriages, horse carriages, one used by Ellen, automobiles from the early days. They have a treasure trove of Story material over there.
So even though his children went elsewhere, some were in Los Angeles and one didn't marry or something, didn't have children?
Yeah, that would, well, Walter, he did marry. He came down as a young man. He kind of started to hang out as Los Angeles was becoming Hollywood, and you had all these starlets and what have you. He came down with gonorrhea, a case of Colonel Flu, and that pretty much precluded him having any children.
Did the grandchildren come back?
A few of them, yeah, a few of them did. There was also the Hogans. His daughter Rose married a Dr. Hogan, and a lot of the Hogans lived down there, but some of them did come on back. Martha Story Drysdale, who's still here, she would be the great-granddaughter of Nelson and Ellen. Bine would be, of course, her grandfather. A lot of divisions in the family. They had a terrible fight over the estate. A lot of it, Malcolm, I don't know, if you've lived here long enough, you might remember Malcolm. His statue is across from the museum over there. But Malcolm, Nelson's grandson, he was quite the character. But he was also a big history buff, and he kept a lot of family records. And he had a lot of the letters that were written by Bine to him and his brother back in the 1940s, 1950s, explaining all this stuff, the good, the bad, and the ugly. He preserved those, gave them to the museum. So that was one huge source of all of that. And another important source was the clerk of the court's office here. When I went through there, my wife, she helped me. We went through every court case from the 1860s up into the mid-1920s to find anything on Nelson's story, and found quite a bit of stuff. The arrest record. He was arrested after that time he abused Ellen, paid a fine, and didn't have to serve any time in jail. But that was also another really good source. And the newspapers as well were pretty good at having some of that. They covered his fights with Joe Lindley. I think one of the headlines stated, "Story and Lindley at it again." I mean, in those days, the headlines were just honest and open. You know, somebody died, Joe Smith drops dead. I mean, big headlines, not just, they didn't sugarcoat anything in the press in those days. But yeah, there were other sources, and Malcolm, all things considered, the fact that he saved a lot of family documents, that was probably the most important. And the trial, the transcript from the trial when the kids fought over the estate, that brought out a lot of things as well.
Whose son was Malcolm?
Bynes, Thomas Byron. Malcolm, as a young man, lived in the SAE house. His brother was Byron Jr., who was known as Budge. Story family was big on nicknames. TB was known as Bine, and one of his sons, Byron Jr., was known as Budge. One of his daughters was known as Peach. That's just how they went through. Big on nicknames. Peter was Malcolm's adopted son. And when I first started this back in the 90s, I got in touch with Pete, and he was very polite about it. But he said, you know, that Nelson wasn't really a saint. And I says, yeah, I know that. And for that, he says, well, sorry, but just not gonna help out on that. I said, okay. Because Malcolm had all his copies of all his stuff, I learned later. So that kind of saved the project. Malcolm, he met Rose, his wife, Malcolm's wife, Rose. He met her when he went to business college, I think in Poughkeepsie, New York, went to a business college, and she was from Kentucky. And they married. He brought her back here. For a while, he lived in Los Angeles to help run the Story family rental properties down there. But he missed Montana too much, so he came back. They had that house on South Wilson. Pink was her favorite color because of her name, Rose. And there is still an attachment, there is still a clause, and it goes down, it was set up to where it goes down to every owner. House has to be pink. If you buy the house, fine. The little shed out there, Malcolm lived in there for a while and rented out the house after his wife died. But if you want that property, fine. There's a clause in the contract for deed, warranty deed, it stays pink because that was her favorite color. Must have had a good lawyer to set all that up. But anyway, there's a lot more to it, obviously, and a lot more detail. And that I think that you can garner from the book.
When you give dollar figures, are you talking about, for example, the Dutch oven that was a dollar? Was that $1860?
Yeah, that was $1860.
$100, $1860. So what's that like?
I was thinking of putting in a table, but the figures change so much as time goes by. And there's tons of websites where you can plug in $200, 1867. What is it worth today? I'll tell you. Because those are more up to date. So, but yeah, that was anything he earned. Give you an idea of, it was all in dollars at the time. Give you an idea of how much they doted on Rose even after she was married. Course of her life in gifts, real estate, cash, all of that, you add it up, she received about $700,000. Went to trial in the 1930s. She wanted more, but that's another story. It's all, could you be successful in those days and be honest? It's a good question. Yeah, you could. You wouldn't be as wealthy as Nelson Story. Everybody, pretty much everybody in town here knew what was going on, knew about him. But as long as the money trickled down, and it's important to note, as symbolized through Story, this town, this valley, largely was built by federal money. Fort Ellis, the town that saved Bozeman, quote unquote. The Crow Reservation, government contracts, the land grant college. All of those Nelson Story had a hand in. If you take those aspects out of Bozeman, we're probably the size of Big Timber. Which in the minds of some people wouldn't be so bad, you know? Yeah.
This town got started, and you know, basically I think it was to try to get as much from the miners as
yes.
they could. And so that kind of sets the tone for the rest of the history of this place, right?
That's right. It did start out.
An honest place.
No, it wasn't. And imagine living in Alder Gulch. There's really no law to speak of. You have all these road agents. You have guys getting shot and killed in saloons over nothing, practically. There's no law and order. And that attitude just stuck and stayed with people and kind of flowed into business as well. Yeah, Leander Black, his hands were dirty. Lester Wilson, not so much. A little bit, but not so much. John Bogert, to a slight extent. If everybody found out a lot about all of these so-called founding fathers, they might want to change some street names. But could end up being like that rock song, the town with where the streets have no names, you know? Thank you very much. And well, we've all got a little capitalist in us, so I hope you'll spread the word about the book. And I like to think it'll not only tell you about those times and about Nelson's story, but also give you a good historical overview of the early founding of this community and what it went through to basically get to where it is today.
You have just heard a talk by local Bozeman historian and director of the Gallatin Historical Society, John C. Russell, reading from his book, Treasure State Tycoon, Nelson's Story and the Making of Montana, published by the Montana Historical Society Press. It was recorded on December 10th, 2019, at the Country Bookshelf. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for listener-supported Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.